This is Bloomberg Business Week. Insight from the reporters and editors who bring you America's most trusted business magazine. Plus, global business, finance, and tech news as it happens. Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Masser and Bloomberg Quick Takes' Tim Stenovic on Bloomberg Radio.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to the weekend edition of Bloomberg Business Week. We've got a special installment of our show this week. We're going to bring you highlights from our coverage of the Milken Institute Global Conference in Beverly Hills.
It's an annual convening of global leaders in government, finance, health, academia, and philanthropy. Last year's event was scaled down and completely remote due to COVID-19. But this year, we were there once again on the ground at the Beverly Hilton Hotel. And it was a reduced crowd size, about half of the attendees as usual. And Carol, everybody was wearing masks, vaccinated and tested. This year's event, it centered on the theme of charting a new course. We spent three jam-packed days examining the disruptions and innovations brought on by the global pandemic, along with social crises, economic hardships that we've seen develop over the past year and a half.
Some of those hardships spurred on by ongoing supply chain shortages. That was something that came into so many of our conversations at Milken. We're going to get into that and specifically what the White House is doing to relieve some of those pressures. We'll do that with the Siemens USA president and CEO, Barbara Humpton. I have to say overall, Tim, it was just so many of the main macro themes, whether it's supply chains, whether it's tensions with China, whether it's finding enough employees, the workforce, you know, that was really top of mind for everybody at Milken.
One of the highlights of the conference, at least for me, and I know it was for you as well, was when you got to sit down for 40 minutes with none other than ARK Invest's Kathy Wood.
Yeah, she's the founder, she's the CEO, she's the CIO of really one of the ETFs funds that in the last 7 years has just taken the world on big time with her disruptive and innovative investing strategy. We had a wide-ranging discussion, everything from China to Tesla, of course. She says ARK's base case is $3,000 a share. We even did a little bit of crypto talk as well. It was timely because we sat down on the day that the new ProShares Bitcoin ETF made its debut, and I asked her about that.
Speaking of crypto, eToro calls itself the world's largest social trading network, and it is seeing explosive growth in the crypto space. We talked to eToro co-founder and CEO Yoni Assia. He still expects to go public with a SPAC in the fourth quarter of the year.
We also talked some politics. Former Labor and Transportation Secretary Elaine Chao, she stopped by to talk infrastructure, the job market, and the shadow cast by former President Donald Trump over the Republican Party, particularly in the wake of the January 6th riot at the U.S. Capitol building.
Plus, the woman behind one of the biggest ESG stories of the year, Engine Number One CEO Jennifer Grancio, shed light on her company's impact investing strategy and the company's new total value framework, which establishes forward valuations of public companies based on their progress with ESG initiatives. You heard about the story with ExxonMobil. I mean, it really truly was a David versus Goliath story.
I gotta say, I'm a fangirl. Can I say that?
You can say it. I'll allow it.
Okay, thank you. All of that and more to come. We begin with Orlando Bravo. He is founder and managing partner at Thoma Bravo. He joined us to talk about the state of SPACs. And he could not have been more excited to get back to doing business in person after a year and a half of Zooms and virtual meetings. You could just feel how much happiness he had to be there in person at Milken.
The conference is awesome. Think about it. We're here in LA. A lot of it is outside. The weather's perfect. I've gotten to see some of our limited partners that I hadn't seen in 2 to 3 years.
Wow.
So some of the old friends, and also meet a lot of new people. So it's just been great. One meeting after the other, right? 15-minute meetings and then trying to see as many people
face
as we can.
Face-to-face, like, it's remarkable, right?
Unbelievable.
So what? Okay, let's talk about SPACs. Because I was looking at some of the indexes. They're down as a group about 10% so far this year. They're down about 30% if you look at certain indexes from the mid-February high. Where are we? Because people are talking about the death of SPACs. And as Tim mentioned earlier, I mean, these are cycles that things go through. SPACs are not a new investment vehicle.
Exactly. SPACs are going to come back. They are. They've been around for, whatever, 25 or 30 years. But why do we think that there was this incredible craze to SPACs? It's because technology companies, there's so much innovation and so much new business creation and so many tech companies being formed that are getting to scale that the financial markets are trying to adapt of how can we absorb all these new assets into the market.
Because we're not seeing a lot of IP. I mean, we saw the IPO market fall off a little bit, right?
It did, and now it's back.
Now it's back. But I'm just saying that, you know, that there's alternatives for going public here.
And the alternatives are great. Direct listings are great. And the SPAC provides a great alternative because what it really, really does is it allows a company to be able to openly talk about its projections
right.
with its investors. Every investor, think about it, if you're looking to buy a company, if we are together going to buy a private company, wouldn't we like to sit down with management and say, let's see what you've done in the past and how do you think about next year and the following year? And how does your operating plan and strategic plan align with that financial plan that you have? It gives you so much insight mm-hmm. as to how management thinks about their own business.
But are you concerned at all that there is a lack of quality companies to be acquired by SPACs that are out there looking for targets right now?
I'm always concerned about quality. What ended up happening as well with this SPAC boom is a number of companies went public through SPACs or merged with SPACs that are venture capital companies, mm-hmm. that are really young companies. Now, retail investors in particular participated in that because the regulatory environment doesn't allow them to participate in venture capital and private equity.
Right.
So they rush to this market. And then the regulators get worried that, oh, they're going to lose money, or these companies have lack of a track record, or they're going to miss their numbers. Now, we'll see what ultimately happens. But one of the things you said at the beginning is SPACs are out of favor now. Of course, nobody likes SPACs. But the trading should be the underlying company.
Correct.
Forget of whether it was a SPAC or IPO or direct listing. It's what matters is the underlying business.
That was Orlando Bravo, the founder and managing partner at Thoma Bravo. Obviously enthusiastic about the SPAC market. And look, he's undeterred with the recent struggles that we've seen.
Yeah, definitely. All right, coming up, a close look at the U.S. labor market and the need for a bipartisan infrastructure spending bill. We'll get that from someone with deep knowledge of both areas, former Labor and Transportation Secretary Elaine Chao.
Plus, she weighs in on whether or not she'd support Donald Trump in 2024 if he runs. You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week. This is Bloomberg.
This is Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Masser and Bloomberg Quick Takes Tim Stenovic from Bloomberg Radio.
Two of the hottest political topics in the nation these days, yeah, they seem to be infrastructure and the job market, rightfully so, really. Specifically, we're talking about the tug of war between employers who want people back in the office and the millions of workers who want more flexibility in the wake of the pandemic.
Well, our next guest has expert knowledge in both issues. Her career in public service has spanned nearly four decades. She's worked in three different presidential administrations, including as Secretary of Labor under George W. Bush, and most recently as Transportation Secretary under President Donald Trump.
We are, of course, talking about Elaine Chao. She took part in a panel discussion surrounding the future of work at this year's Milken Institute Global Conference. And then she joined us to break down how companies are approaching America's labor landscape and what sort of work patterns they can expect from employees going forward.
They're taking polling more. They're asking their employees more. And clearly, some kind of hybrid working environment arrangement will be much more accepting to employees. And I think employers are trying to work this out.
Right.
And, you know, at first they were going to come back to work. The workforce was going to come back to work last September. Then it was last December. Then it was the spring. Then it was going to be September. And now people are talking about spring of 2022. So clearly we're all feeling our way as to how to come back at that.
There is this imbalance happening, though, right now. When we look at the labor market, there is an oversupply of workers, but they are not actually returning to the workforce. Do you think we ever get back to a workforce that looks like it looked before the pandemic? Like, is it realistic for us to think about it from those numbers?
Yeah, it's even more before the pandemic. When I was labor secretary, the labor participation rate was about 66%. With a workforce of about 157 million people.
Right.
And then we had the Great Recession. And then the labor participation rate dropped to about 63, and it kind of never recovered. Mm-hmm. And with the COVID then, it went from 63.3 or 4 down to 61.7, 61.1. So we're continuing to see declines in labor participation, which is terrible because we need these workers to come back to fuel a full recovery. But there's also another factor, another dynamic at play here, and that is the skills gap.
Yeah. Well, we've been talking about this for years, Elaine.
Yes.
And I'm going to throw in another problem. We've been talking about infrastructure for years. How many administrations, right? And this is something that has had bipartisan support. What ultimately, from your perspective, do we have to start spending on when it comes to infrastructure?
Well,
look at the supply chains and the
I'm
problems.
I'm for, obviously, investing in transportation infrastructure. The reason that the Trump administration was never able to succeed in the infrastructure proposal was because there was a big debate about whether there should be $1 for $1 of investment spending. Mm-hmm. And the Republicans believed that there can be leverage, that we can use public-private partnerships and leverage existing government dollars. And the Democrats felt that they wanted $1 for $1 deficit spending, which obviously the pros and cons to both. So we were never able to galvanize enough consensus around public-private partnerships. This time around, I think there could be, I think there's an infrastructure bill, a transportation infrastructure bill to be had. Unfortunately, now it's being held hostage to the budget reconciliation bill.
Right.
If it were to be stand alone, there is a deal to be made and passed on the infrastructure bill. And I'm hopeful that it would be passed before year end.
I feel like politics. I mean, I want to ask you, because you've been in politics for such a long
time. I'm not in politics. I am a public servant. I've always viewed myself as being in public service.
I did say you were a longtime public servant. The Republican Party, if I think about the January 6th Capitol riot, you resigned after that.
Yes, I did.
You left the Trump administration. You were there, almost to the end. Do you regret being part of that administration?
I'm very grateful for the opportunity to serve my country. I'm an immigrant to this country. I came when I was 8 years old. I didn't get my citizenship until 19. And it used to be that if the president asked, the only answer you can give is yes. I didn't know the president very well, but I also believe that the American people deserve to have a functioning government. But going back to the infrastructure bill, the real drama is on the Democrat side. Because as I mentioned, there is a bill to be had. There was bipartisan support. Republicans signed on to this infrastructure bill.
Right.
But the speaker, and she and I share a birthday, by the way.
Nancy
she's
Pelosi.
In a tough. Yes, she's in a tough spot.
Yeah.
Because she's got moderates who want to hold back on the spending.
Well,
she's
so
got progressives that want to spend more. So she's trying to balance that.
Right.
But if left alone, that infrastructure bill can move on its own.
Many
so all the drama is on the Democrat side.
And you know this. You follow what's been going on in the economy, certainly in the pandemic. Milken covers this left and right, the inequities that we have seen. And it's not new. And there are people who have not shared in the wealth creation. And so that softer infrastructure that the president and his team are trying to get through, I mean, this is part of the battle. And
I think for those people that question that, they're not saying that these social infrastructure proposals are unworthy. What they're saying basically is, should they be included in what was originally going to be called a transportation infrastructure
bill? But you know
bill.
How politics works, that if, okay, we got infrastructure done, we're done.
So it was originally, the original infrastructure bill had only 6% of what is traditionally defined as transportation infrastructure. If you expand the explanation and the description a bit more generously, you get up to 30% of the dollars. But clearly, there is a need for transportation infrastructure. Roads, bridges, transit, ports, airports.
Drive around New York, right?
Absolutely.
I mean,
a governor got elected on this. I won't repeat her slogan.
We have to ask because we only have about a minute or so.
Yeah, I know you consider yourself a public servant, but we got to ask more politics.
Oh, shoot. Why?
Are you talking with Donald?
Yeah.
Have you heard from Donald Trump at all?
We have not spoken.
Not at all.
But I'm not, I'm out of politics
now. You are, but you did
serve in
three.
I've always been in public policy.
You served in three administrations. Do you consider President Trump is the leader right now of the Republican Party?
Well, I think that is in the process of being decided and sorted out. There's still some time to go. There's 2022 coming up, and then there's 2024.
Should he be the leader of the Republican Party?
That's up to the people. I think for those who wonder about his appeal, they should be asking, what is it that prompts so many Americans to support him? And I think that's the answer will be very, very revealing.
And
it's a teaching, it's something that I think, leadership should understand.
But as someone who came to this country as an immigrant and became a citizen, do you think, a voting citizen, that he should be president? Or should
be
leader? Should be leader of the Republican Party.
I will support the nominee. I'm a Republican, so I will support whoever the nominee is.
That was former Labor and Transportation Secretary Elaine Chao. An important conversation, especially for lawmakers gearing up for midterm elections next year. Also, fiscal spending will continue to be a source of contention between now and next November. I thought her comments about not necessarily considering herself a politician were particularly interesting.
Yeah, I agree with you.
Considering how much time she spent in Washington.
I mean, a ton of time. And she still spends a lot of time in Washington. She is, of course, the wife of Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell. We'll dig into the labor side of things a bit more. We're going to catch up with the CEO of a company called Bright Machines. He says automation might actually be a good thing. Yes, a good thing, you heard right, for workers.
Coming up next on Bloomberg Business Week, eToro calls itself the world's largest social trading network. The company is ready to go public.
It is indeed. The CEO of eToro joining us next. This is Bloomberg.
Broadcasting from the financial capital of the world, Bloomberg 1130 in New York, to Washington, D.C., Bloomberg 991, to Boston, Bloomberg 1061, to San Francisco, Bloomberg 960, to the country, Sirius XM Channel 119, and around the globe, the Bloomberg Business App and BloombergRadio.com. This is Bloomberg Business Week.
Retail investors, they have become a dominant market-moving force over the last year and a half.
And those investors are also trending younger with platforms like Robinhood and Webull. Those platforms give millions of novice traders easy access to public markets just through their smartphones. eToro has also been working on this for more than a decade, building its user base.
And it's since grown into what it says is the world's largest social trading network. It previously delayed its planned $10.4 billion SPAC public listing due to the SEC's increased scrutiny of such deals. They've been looking very deeply into the transparency of SPACs. We know that. Well, now eToro's IPO, back on track.
That's thanks in part to soaring interest and investment in Bitcoin and other cryptocurrencies. That's at least according to the company's co-founder and CEO, who expects that trend to continue.
Yoni Assia traveled to the Milken Institute Global Conference all the way from Israel, where his company is based. He told us it was his first visit to LA in about 25 years. As for his company, he was very optimistic.
We've seen explosive growth over the past 18 months, really starting, as we talked about before, with the beginning of the pandemic, just at the inflection point in the rise of retail investors, with a whole new generation across the world, millennials, realizing that they want to invest in the markets, whether it's stock markets, whether it's U.S. stock markets, or whether it's crypto markets, just increased interest all around the world. We founded the company in 2007 with a vision of opening the global markets for everyone to trade and invest in a simple and transparent way, and up until 2020, beginning of 2020, we had about 12 million registered users, and since then we added more than 11 new million registered users by the end of the first half 2021. So basically, we doubled the company, more than doubled the company.
So 23 million? How many?
So 23 million registered users worldwide, grew by 5.6 million registered users the first 6 months this year, after growing about 5 million registered users the entire of last year. We've grown significantly our business, and we've seen the shift from the first crypto rally in 2017. We've seen our business grow rapidly from $60 million commission to $390 million from 2016 to 2018, really driven by the crypto rally.
Yeah.
And then we saw crypto winter, and in crypto winter, we sort of drove our customers who came to eToro to trade back then, you know, XRP, Ethereum, to diversify into equities through the social network, where they can actually see what other people are trading and see each other's performance and copy the most successful investors. And then we saw crypto winter shifted the business into equities and commission-free stock trading worldwide, and then started this year with crypto rally 2.0, which is just an amazing rally.
Yoni, I hear what you're saying, and I imagine some of our listeners are thinking to themselves, wait a second, this is a similar story as to what propelled Robinhood to the public markets in a relatively short time into such massive growth in the year 2020 and 2021. But we are seeing that Robinhood shares are down more than 40%, partly due to some softness with the company referred to as seasonality earlier this year. Are you seeing any of that decline in activity, any of that seasonality that we heard from Robinhood?
So sensitive to the fact that we're in the process of transforming from a private company to a public company, I can only share companies' data relevant for the first 6 months, which we published, which were very good. We did update the markets that Q3, and this is something you can look at exchange data. So equities have been softer in Q3. If you look just at exchange data, options data, volumes in equities and volatility.
It was a tough September.
have gone down generally in the markets. And now we're seeing, obviously, crypto Rally 2.0, the longest crypto rally in crypto history, in Q4 sort of returning with a roar. So hoping to see Bitcoin reach all-time high, already peaked and touched actually market cap all-time high over the last 48 hours. So very interesting to see what's happening in crypto in Q4.
Yoni, who are you competing against? Is it Robinhood? Is it all of the online trading platforms, even the establishment? Who is it?
So the way we see it, and again, we're very global, and we have our businesses Europe, U.S., Asia, Latin America, Middle East. We're regulated across the world, and in every single country, what we see is the discount brokerage 1.0 was very much consolidated by the local banks. So here, you know, Schwab bought TD, Morgan Stanley bought E-Trade, and we see the same in Germany, in Italy, in Spain, in the UK, everywhere. But who we're really competing in against is those super apps, right? Apps like eToro, who are attractive to a new audience, new customers that are beginning their trading activity, are looking for new tools, for ways to engage and learn how to trade the markets, how to participate in the markets. And there's a lot of great companies just expanding the audience and expanding the markets.
That's Yoni Assia. He's the co-founder and CEO over at eToro.
You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week. Coming up next, one of the headliners at Milken this year, our audience very familiar with her, ARK Invest founder, CEO, and CIO, Kathy Wood. And not surprisingly, Carol, her biggest bets, well, they're continuing to pay off.
Her commitments to Tesla and Bitcoin, as strong as ever. She also explains the role Jack Ma played in her China investment strategy. This is Bloomberg.
You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Bloomberg Quick Takes Tim Stenovic from Bloomberg Radio.
When you want to talk innovation, disruption, how to place your bets on the future, if there's one person you need to hear from, it's Kathy Wood, Tim.
The ARK Invest founder, CEO, and CIO is known for her foresight on game-changing technology. And so far, she's proving to be right on a number of those big bets, specifically Tesla and EVs, as well as, of course, Bitcoin.
I sat down with her for a wide-ranging discussion at Milken. She was one of the headliners, and it happened just ahead of Tesla's latest earnings release. The company would report third-quarter revenue that fell short of Wall Street estimates, but it did manage to beat profit projections.
In this excerpt, Kathy begins by explaining her initial attraction to investing in what is now the world's preeminent EV maker, Tesla.
We actually took our cues from a value investor who said to us, I would never buy one stock in your portfolio, but I like your research and you might be right, so I'm gonna just put 5%. This is a value investor, 5% as a hedge. And as did our first institutional investor, which is value-oriented,
right,
and kind of thought we were behaving like a value manager, long-term time horizon, and looking for extreme values. Well, value investors are using price to book and dividend yield and that sort of thing. We're using growth. You know, we're using spectacular growth rates that no one is expecting. And Tesla was our first proof of concept, I would say, a very visible one, where people were saying, what are they talking about? And all we had done was used Wright's Law, which is the centerpiece of our research, to try and figure out how quickly costs would decline in battery pack systems, and therefore how much prices would fall for electric vehicles, and how quickly the uptake would be. And we saw Elon Musk, magnificent things happening in terms of
costs.
But
it wasn't so easy to be invested in Tesla early on.
For us, it was easy.
Because you just believe the story, or?
The most important call that we made initially with Tesla was, all right, Tesla's battery technology is unlike any other auto manufacturer's battery technology. Tesla was riding down the cost curve of the consumer electronics industry. So laptops, cell phones, huge volumes, right? And when you get a scaling like that, costs come down. It's called a learning curve in the tech industry. So Elon you had auto manufacturers and auto analysts laughing at him. Elon is building his car on top of cell phone batteries. Isn't that funny? And what they didn't believe was that the engineering was possible.
Right.
So there was a, it wasn't, they just didn't think it was possible. And he did. And so even today, these cylindrical batteries that he's been using relative to lithium ion pouch, lower cost and will remain lower cost for at least 3 years, we think, which means that any other auto manufacturer who wants the same performance and the same range at the same price will have to lose money on every car sold.
So it keeps him in a really great position.
And that's only one of four barriers to entry.
Well,
but that was the first call we had to make.
So Elon Musk and Tesla. So there is a point that you would get out. I know there's a story you've talked about. You put a mark on the stock price. I think it was 3,000?
Yeah, 3,000 is our base case. Not our bull case, but our base case.
Okay, so there is a point where you could say, okay, I'm moving on. You've gotten out of Apple.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, these are backward-looking companies or technologies that you don't think are, or no, not necessarily?
Not necessarily. They are very well understood. Their dynamics are well understood. They are the fangs.
Right.
They're well owned, and we just want our clients to be exposed to the next fangs, which are not going to be in the fang category, but the next fangs. And Tesla is becoming a fang. You know, I think
right.
It'll end up in that grouping at some point. So, yeah, what we would sell. So, our minimum hurdle rate of return expectation for a stock is 15% at an annualized rate over 5 years. So, a doubling over 5 years. Tesla is about nearly a quadrupling over 5 years, so
right.
Well within our range. So, you know, we have been taking profits, and that's because Tesla in here, I think it's becoming very obvious now that electric vehicles are taking massive share from traditional gas-powered vehicles.
So we've talked Tesla, we've talked a little bit. Tell me a little bit more about Bitcoin and where you see, I mean, I've never seen anything so debated. Obviously, we're seeing more legitimization as we see regulators, certainly in the U.S. and around the world, moving forward. What is the long-term play when it comes to something like cryptocurrencies and Bitcoin?
So Bitcoin specifically, we got involved when it was a $6 billion market cap. And here's Art Laffer again in my life and in ARK's life. It was a $6 billion cap then, now it's over a trillion, which is, but we were asking the question, this was 2015, could Bitcoin serve the three roles of money? And we came to the conclusion that it was possible. Art Laffer collaborated, he tore our original paper up, and as we were going through it, he said, this is the rules-based monetary system I've been waiting for since we left the gold exchange standard, 1971.
Right.
And I said to him, oh, how big could this be? And he said, well, how big is the US monetary base? And back then, remember, this is a $6 billion cap. Back then, it was a $4.5 trillion monetary base. Today, we're at $8.5 trillion.
China,
yes.
You've been in, you've been out. And sometimes we're trying to understand.
Yes, yes.
So how are we supposed to look at China right now? And the clampdowns that we've seen in the government, certainly on different sectors,
yes.
That have just decimated those sectors in terms of the value of them.
Yes.
So what do you expect kind of to be your involvement?
Yes.
An investment
our,
play?
Our first move away from China was when China was had a very strong move, and what you know the innovation there was being deeply appreciated while
right.
Ours was not. So that was that kind of move. The second time we moved in, then we moved in, why? We saw the reaction to COVID and we got more interested because it was the most disciplined country in terms of both monetary and fiscal policy during the crisis. And I thought that China had the possibility of becoming the Germany and Switzerland of the world, you know, in terms of discipline, monetary and fiscal. As soon as Jack Ma was banished, effectively,
right.
Last November, we started pulling back. Because what we're doing, and especially during February through May, where our strategy, just to give you a sense how volatile it is, our strategy from mid-February through mid-May, most people wouldn't admit this maybe, but this is how volatile we are.
Yeah.
Transparency was down 37%, peak to trough. So we have come back, but during that period, what we do, as we always do, we concentrated our portfolio towards our highest conviction names. China was moving away because almost every week and month there was a new regulatory move,
right,
or crackdown. And so it was easy to do that. It was great because I'm always scrambling, looking for cash during a correction. Okay, where's the confidence lower? Where, let's buy into some of these, our favorites,
right,
here. Now, common prosperity. So what have we done? No China in our flagship. We do own some China in a few of our portfolios, the ones focused on autonomous technology and robotics. But we're very particular, very low margin companies, because margin is clearly not appreciated by the government anymore, common prosperity.
Right.
And very beneficial to tier three, tier four cities, common prosperity. So JD Logistics, JD.com, Pinduoduo.
Does it stay this way, do you think, in China for a while?
Well,
I mean, it's hard to say,
yes,
but China is certainly a country when they make a decision, it's longer term. It's longer term planning.
Right.
And President Xi certainly seems to be on this mission.
And I think he is very unsettled that the three-child policy is not working.
Yeah.
And so there is a big social engineering. And by the way, this was all very forecastable, right? I mean, demographics, they knew 50 years ago what was going to happen.
Right.
So I think that's part of it. And, you know, there are the haves and the have-nots in China, like there are, like there is around the world. I think China's taking it more seriously because there's probably more social unrest than we now appreciate. What I don't understand is they're going after real estate, which is 75% of the consumer savings in China.
That was ARK Invest CEO, CIO, and of course, founder Kathy Wood from the Milken Institute Global Conference. Check out the full interview on the Bloomberg Terminal and at Bloomberg.com. And that wraps up the first hour of the weekend edition of Bloomberg Business Week from Bloomberg Radio, a special edition, the West Coast LA Cool Beverly Hills edition. I'm Carol Masser.
And I'm Tim Stenovec. Ahead in our next hour, more heavyweights from Milken 2021. We'll talk supply chain troubles and the Biden administration's plan to ease the pain. Siemens USA President and CEO Barbara Humpton takes us inside the White House.
She was there talking about some of the problems. Plus, we'll hear from one executive who sees a parallel between current market conditions and the post-World War II economy. Tim and I were talking about this a lot after this conversation. And then we've got another one who expects increased automation to be a potential net positive for the workforce. You heard that right.
And one of the biggest names in the growing field of impact investing, Engine Number One CEO Jennifer Granzio. She got Exxon's attention and everyone else's. It's a David and Goliath story. You know it.
Yep.
This is Bloomberg.
This is Bloomberg Business Week. Insight from the reporters and editors who bring you America's most trusted business magazine. Plus, global business, finance, and tech news as it happens. Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Masser and Bloomberg Quick Takes Tim Stenovec on Bloomberg Radio.
Hi, I'm Carol Masser.
And I'm Tim Stenovec. Plenty ahead in our second hour of the weekend edition of Bloomberg Business Week. As we bring back some of our favorite conversations from the Milken Institute Global Conference, back in full force this year after the 2020 event was completely remote due to the COVID pandemic.
In just a bit, in fact, we'll hear from Barbara Humpton, President and CEO of Siemens USA, who says the White House has a good plan to help relieve certain supply chain bottlenecks she should know being involved in a meeting at the White House.
Plus, we'll talk with Bright Machine CEO Amar Hanspal on what the next wave of automation and AI technology means for the modern worker. Maybe it's not all bad. Also, Scott Minard of Guggenheim Investments on modern monetary theory, MMT, becoming a reality.
Hashtag MMT, it's happening. First up this hour, let's focus on impact investing. Earlier this year, a company called Engine Number One, you know who we're talking about, well, they scooped up three seats on Exxon's board of directors. It was a big, big win for investors who are demanding that their profits come with a greater purpose.
The small activist fund now is the world's attention as it pushes for more emphasis on sustainability at the oil giant. And it's touting what it calls a total value framework. It ties progress on ESG initiatives directly to financial value creation. The company's CEO, Jennifer Grancio, explains.
We set out with Engine Number One to do things in a different way. And so instead of what we all think of as slightly older school, ESG, people aren't sure if it works, people aren't sure if they get returns, we built Engine Number One to take the data, the environmental or the climate or the governance data, and use it to drive returns. And so as I've watched and talked with lots of people over the last couple of days, large pools of assets, as well as younger people, people are ready.
But they're ready because the performance is there, or they're just ready because it's the right thing to do? What is it?
They're ready. They're ready to have impact in their investments, but they're not willing to do it with giving up returns. So the way they think about it is we care about people and wages and workers, we care about climate, but we need investors to do it for us in a way where we don't give up returns.
So Jennifer, is it harder though for a company that is delivering the returns to kind of get them to make the changes, and investors are maybe not going to be so supportive because they're like, listen, I like these returns. So give me an idea.
Yeah, we think it's all about using the data on climate or environment, people using it to drive returns over time. So to take an example, let's take General Motors. Mm-hmm. So Mary Barr's got a great business. She's a great CEO. She's got a strong board. But they can actually make more money if they get to an EV transition faster.
Longer term.
Longer term, but if you think about it from a scale perspective, so what's the multiple of GM today compared to Tesla? Let's take mm-hmm. that example. If you can get to an EV transition sooner and you're doing 9 million electric cars a year, that's a huge increase in multiple for GM, and we get to the climate transition sooner. So yes, it takes more than a quarter.
Yeah.
But it's the way to do it at scale.
Hey, talk to us about your investing framework and how you think about potential targets. Our audience absolutely familiar with what Engine Number One has done and did earlier this year at ExxonMobil, mm-hmm. and also, of course, at General Motors, too. But how do you think about your next potential targets?
Yeah, we think about it as being active owners in all these companies as opposed to target or old school activism. So what does that mean? That means we're running with all the public companies, every single one. We run through their wages, their workers, their social impact, and their climate and environmental impact. We do it in dollar cents. And then we forecast mm-hmm. how does that change their valuation over time. And so we will work with both companies that are laggards, where we think they're not managing the business as well as they could. And we'll do that constructively. We won't try to do it the way we did with Exxon. It's better to do it working constructively with companies. And so we're working with a number of companies now, but behind the scenes. We don't talk about that as much.
Tim was doing, we were doing some research. Tim shared a story with me, and we've been following this. Dow Jones, had reported that Exxon is debating abandoning some of its biggest oil and gas projects. Do you feel like win?
Well, I think a first win is get the right people on the board. So that was a big victory in getting three people with great energy transition experience.
Right.
And the second win we're looking for is what's the long-term capital allocation strategy. And if Exxon, we're not in the boardroom, they're independent directors, but
right.
if Exxon, with the new people on the board, comes to a decision to rethink long-term petroleum development, we think that's very smart for business.
And the environment.
Well, what does that ExxonMobil look like to you? I mean, help us understand that, because I think people think of ExxonMobil as like the opposite of think about the business that it's in.
Yeah.
Right? It drills for fossil fuels.
It's an energy company. And so if you think about the expertise that Exxon has, they have huge IP in great technologies and lithium batteries traditionally. They were a founder pioneer from a research perspective.
Right.
And then they have an ability to execute things at huge scale. If you want to do energy, even a new kind of energy at scale, think about the engineering capability of a Chevron or an Exxon to do that. So they're an energy company. They don't only have to be an oil company 10 and 20 years in the future.
So in terms of industries, I know you can't probably reveal, I don't want to say the word targets, I know that's what we keep thinking, but I mean, what are the industries that you think you're going to be looking at or are currently looking at pretty aggressively when it comes to doing the research that you know, are transitioning, need to be transitioning for the better of all mankind.
Yeah, I think the heavy fossil fuel industries are definitely, I mean, definitely that's an obvious one.
Right.
Which is why you see us talking about energy and talking about transportation. That's a place where you transform and companies can be much more profitable and you get to better climate impacts sooner. There are also financial services. Square is an example where Square's business is Cash App in particular, is serving underserved communities. It's driving financial inclusion that has huge positive benefit.
That was Jennifer Grancio, the CEO of Engine Number One, the activist hedge fund. She joined us earlier this week at the Milken Institute Global Conference.
You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week. Coming up, more of our conversations. You know, the Biden administration pulling out all the stops to relieve bottlenecks at the nation's most critical ports of entry, and industrial executives definitely take a notice.
Siemens USA President and CEO Barbara Humpton takes us inside the White House's blueprint to fix America's fractured supply chains. This is Bloomberg.
This is Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Masser and Bloomberg Quick Takes Tim Stenovic from Bloomberg Radio.
So supply chains, that was definitely one of the topics we talked about a lot at Milken this past week. Supply chains, they connect nearly every component of the global economy, and even the world's wealthiest and most powerful companies are proving vulnerable to shocks.
Among those is Siemens, the engineering and manufacturing company. It focuses on areas of electrification, automation, digitization, transportation, all of those being hit by the global semiconductor shortage.
Right. We've seen it play out in a lot of the earnings reports as well that have been coming out fast and furiously. Well, we spoke with Siemens USA President and CEO Barbara Humpton at this week's Milken Institute Global Conference. She was among a group of executives tapped by the White House to help figure out how to remove the roadblocks to critical U.S. imports.
While we're a net exporter in the U.S., we actually do rely on supplies coming from elsewhere in the world. Our supply chain team, they became unsung heroes of our pandemic timeframe, where they just came forward with all kinds of creative workarounds, risk management, diversifying our supply chain, making sure that we could be on station for our customers.
Yeah, give us some examples of that, Barbara, and how the team has been able to do that.
Because how do you diversify if supplies are just not there?
Yeah.
Well, what we are finding is that this is a moment when the supply chain is becoming very creative. You know that there are certain things like semiconductors where it will literally take years for us to increase supply in the U.S. But meanwhile, you know, you're seeing this. I'm sure companies all over the world are doing the same thing, aggregating chips from multiple suppliers and then understanding priorities across the business. In our case, it's making sure that our customers who are most critical to the societies they serve, we're in the backbone of economies around the world. Mm-hmm. And so we really do have to prioritize where are these chips going.
All right. Yeah. We have to stay with chips because you were at the White House, right? Or you were in that meeting. Tell us about that, the conversations, and what are the expectations coming out of it?
Yeah. Well, kudos to the White House and Department of Commerce for bringing together players all along the supply chain. Those who are, you know, end users putting chips into end products all the way back to fabs, et cetera. And really what the White House and Commerce are looking for is how can they remove roadblocks? How can they help set up systems so that we improve the supply chain all along? One of the big things is transparency. It's very much like cyber.
What does that mean for chips?
I'll tell you. You know how in cybersecurity, what we've committed as an industry is to tell each other when we encounter issues, and it keeps everybody else alert and aware. We know that a threat to one is a threat to all. Same things with chips. Where are we encountering bottlenecks? What types of chips are we having issues with? And by sharing that information, then where the federal government can help is if there's anything they can do, regulatory or otherwise, to unblock those blockades, then they'll get involved.
Has that happened yet? Have you been able to see anything changed since that meeting just a couple of weeks ago?
Well, the number one thing is we've just started the reporting. So, you know, yes. And I do know that this is a very open administration. They're taking phone calls incessantly from folks who are dealing with issues.
It's easy to get to the White House right now on this.
Absolutely. A top, top issue for them.
When you talk about chips and, like, just the problems, what is the problem? Is it just that there's just not enough being manufactured? Like, what is the real nut that we're trying to crack here?
Here's where we are. We had a global supply chain that was tuned to just in time. And when folks looked at forecasts of what's going to be the demand, post-COVID.
Right.
Midst of COVID, I could say con-COVID and post-COVID, you know, what's the demand going to be? And they reduced their orders. When they did that, what that meant is there was going to be a surge when, in fact, demand came surging back. And now there's huge demand everywhere for those parts.
Is just-in-time over? Was COVID the end of just-in-time?
I've heard a lot of things. I've heard just-in-time, just-in-case, right? But actually, one of the things we're looking at is glocalization. What I think is actually
glocalization,
taking global technologies and then manufacturing, making them in regions all around the world so that there can be more immediate sources of supply.
Easier said than done, though. It can take 3 years to build a chip manufacturing facility.
Well, it can. I mean, what I've been doing is talking to audiences everywhere about the idea of a smart investment these days would be in flex factories. By the way, this is something the U.S. government can do. Some people don't know that there's a organic industrial base maintained by the Department of Defense. Mm-hmm. They have the ability to put new automation technology in that will make them more flexible.
This is so interesting because you go back several decades, right? And the government got so involved in the U.S. semi industry because we were falling behind. The government has to play a much more active role, in your view?
Well, what we're seeing is things like the CHIPS Act. We are such fans of this idea of the government actually making an investment to help jumpstart chip production. The demand will be there. You know that as we go from the Internet of People
right
into this next decade where it will be people creating the Internet of Things, that there's going to be demand for semiconductors everywhere.
We need to talk about people.
No, we do. Yeah, I wanted to get an update because a few months ago you did an interview with Bloomberg TV. You said there were 2,000 open roles at Siemens US. Give us an update there. Are you able to fill those roles?
We are constantly working to fill open jobs. And I will tell you today, we still have about 2,000 open jobs. Yes, we're experiencing growth. And we are also experiencing what so many companies are, with people saying, hey, I'd like to do something different. So a couple things I want to do. I want to change the great resignation to the great reassignment. Get managers thinking about, you know what, I may lose an employee, but I'd rather lose them to one of my colleagues in Siemens if there's somebody who wants to do something different. So let's keep them in the family. I'm really hoping a lot of folks will be coming back as well because we've got this vibrant, growing business. Meanwhile, we're putting a ton of investment into creating programs that will bring young people into the fields we and our customers are engaged in. Most recently, working with Wake Technical Community College in North Carolina, we've created an apprenticeship program for 11th graders to come out, learn the tools of the trade for building electric vehicles.
So starting
chargers.
Earlier and earlier, right?
High school apprenticeship is the new wave of the future.
What is the thing that keeps you up at night? Because I think about, all right, supply chain, we talked about it, chips. I mean, these are still issues. We're not over COVID yet. There are still some questions about the economy, trying to fill all these jobs. What is it that really kind of stresses you out right
now? Yeah, now, Carol, I sleep well because I've got a great team. But the thing we focus on as a number one priority, we use the term sustainability. It means a lot of things to a lot of people. But look at where we are right now. We're entering a winter where there's a real question about where will the power come from. So we're doing our part at Siemens to make sure that utilities are prepared, that communities are prepared. We've been installing microgrids, nanogrids, helping people get ready and so that they'll have greater flexibility and control on how they use power.
That's Siemens USA President and CEO Barbara Humpton. A nice follow-on to our discussion with Jennifer Grancio of Engine Number One. Sustainability, not just key to fighting climate change, but also to maintaining supply chains and sources of energy.
We did see these common threads through all of our conversations. Barbara Humpton of Siemens also touched on something that we'll get into with our next guest, giving workers the skills they need to succeed and stay viable in the post-pandemic economy.
Coming up on Bloomberg Business Week, the CEO of Bright Machines, Amar Hanspal, on the next level of industrial automation as we continue our coverage from the Milken Institute Global Conference. This is Bloomberg.
Broadcasting from the financial capital of the world, Bloomberg 1130 in New York, to Washington, D.C., Bloomberg 991, to Boston, Bloomberg 1061, to San Francisco, Bloomberg 960, to the country, Sirius XM Channel 119, and around the globe, the Bloomberg Business App and BloombergRadio.com. This is Bloomberg Business Week.
So Bright Machines was founded back in 2018, just a few years ago. It's an industrial company that's leveraging a software-first approach to help reimagine how we manufacture various goods.
The company has set out to bring automation to assembly lines around the world, essentially giving eyes and brains to machines to help speed up the production process.
The company's CEO, Amar Hanspal, stopped by our set at the Milken Global Conference this past week to talk about the potential for the tools his company provides and the net effect on the global labor force.
Look at the products surrounding us. So you think of the network infrastructure that's connecting our computers to the internet. You think of the electric vehicles, all the components that go in them. All those pieces. So let's take a piece of network infrastructure. You look at a modern day router. Assembling that router used to be done by hand in a place like China or Mexico. That's the thing that we have replaced using our autonomous assembly line. So robots and other machines are basically putting all the pieces in place and building network boxes, and we're doing that
Amar,
for customers.
I think that's what was kind of surprising, kind of reading in for this, is that I think I had thought so much was already automated.
Right.
Give us your snapshot of what you see.
I mean, the reality is less than 8% of the assembly lines in the world are automated. And you see all, you know, robots have been around for 40 years.
Right.
But the reality has been that to set up these systems takes so much time and costs so much and requires a level of expertise that only, you know, the big automotive or the big aerospace companies that have lots of money and have five-year product cycles have been able to automate. You look at the, you know, any kitchen appliance in your house,
right?
That's not automated because it takes too long to configure or cost too much to configure.
So you're saying
that
my bullet that I use to make my shakes?
It's actually a good example.
Really? It's not automated?
It's like you look at that bullet, pieces of the steel and the plastic are made by machines, but they're all assembled by hand. And that's the kind of thing that when you, you know, and you bring it, you bring technology like ours to bear, you can, you know, assemble that using a modern method.
If ultimately we reach the point where humans are replaced on automation.
You knew we were going to go there.
You had to go there. Then it creates it's a transformational shift when it comes to the labor market. It's something we talked about earlier with David Hunt at PGEM.
Yeah.
Right? You know, this is the type of thing that can actually prevent inflation from getting out of control.
Exactly.
But when does that happen, and what is the massive shift?
So let me give you three parts of the answer. First of all, this kind of high level of automation has happened in other industries. And, you know, banks are a great example. When ATMs came, it didn't result in like unemployment for all the people that, you know, you automated the most repetitive and kind of mind-taxing work. And that's what's happening in manufacturing. If you think about, it's not meant to be dystopian, but when you go into factories today, there are robots everywhere, but the robots are humans. And you'd see humans in factories doing the same operation 100,000 times a day. They'll literally insert screws, you know, four screws into a box and screw. Like, that is mind-numbing work, right? And so that's the kind of thing that systems like ours replaces. But you're right. When we do that, there is somebody that's affected. But what we've seen our customers do is that they look at automation as an augmentation exercise, that they're increasing the ability of a single person to do multiple, you know, more work, or have them do more valuable work, like do better customer service, do better engineering, do better design. And that's what I think will happen. It'll take, definitely you go through a curve where people need to be retrained, but on the other side of it, it's a much better experience for everybody.
Hey, Mar, how do you future-proof these assembly lines?
Yeah.
If a customer makes a big purchase
That's a good point.
And automates it, how do they know 2 years from now it's going to be still good?
So glad you asked that question. Software is the secret sauce. Because what we do through software is make our lines programmable. Mm-hmm. So effectively, since our secret sauce is we use software to configure and run these machines, that software can be used to modify the same line to build a different product.
So we can upgrade the software. Doesn't impact the hardware, the existing hardware,
If you completely change the product, let's say you are building your bullet and now you're going to build a network router, yes, you need to change the end of arm grippers and some of the feeding systems. But if you're upgrading the bullet or you're doing a second model of that, then you don't need to do that.
So you're going to go public this year?
That is the plan. We announced our transaction, 17th of May, a SPAC merger. and we are in the process of de-SPACing. We filed our S-4 today, and you know, when the SEC gives us the go-ahead, then we shall be a public company.
That's Amar Hanspul, the CEO of Bright Machines. Looking forward to speaking with him again once his company hits the public markets.
Definitely. You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week. Coming up, more from Milken. We're going to wrap up our coverage with Scott Minard. He's the CIO over at Guggenheim Investments, very well known to the Bloomberg audience.
Yeah, he is. He's going to tell us why the search for value has never been more difficult and why the U.S. is starting to resemble a post-war economy. This is Bloomberg.
You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Bloomberg Quick Takes Tim Stenovic from Bloomberg Radio.
All right, everybody, it's the question of 2021, inflation, transitory or perpetual? We're going to put a buck in the jar. Who's doing that?
Bostic, Raphael Bostic of the Atlanta Fed.
Right. Every time somebody in the office says transitory inflation, they have to put a buck in the jar. Well, anyway, the never-ending question came up a lot at the Milken Global Conference this past week out on the West Coast. It's getting to a point where even market experts are really kind of unsure where to find value as a result.
That's the story we heard from Scott Minard, the CIO over at Guggenheim Investments. He's a familiar name, of course, to the Bloomberg audience.
And he told us the upward movements and asset prices are unlike any he's seen in his career, and that he sees modern monetary theory, MMT, becoming a reality.
I have never seen a time like this where there is nothing that I can point to that I can call cheap. You know, historically, I remember being interviewed on Bloomberg in 2006 and telling the interviewer that the cheap thing was 10-year treasury notes at 5.25%. And they said, well, who would want 10-year treasury notes? Well, you know, I was concerned about the housing crisis. Today, I can't point to anything that I think that if we got ourselves into trouble, that would actually be cheap to buy today, that has value. So you're left in this world, which I'm not real comfortable in, where you have to find things that are expensive that are probably going to become more expensive. And so,
such as?
Well, I mean, cryptocurrency, yeah. Right? You know, I mean, Shiba, if you invested in Shiba coin back in the first quarter of this year, $1,000 today would be worth $2.1 million, right? I mean, can I find another Shiba coin? I don't know, but...
Okay, but we're talking about something that a lot of people think is a joke.
Well, Shiba coin was a joke created to mimic Dogecoin, which was a joke. Right? So,
do
I mean,
those cancel each other out.
Yeah, well, I don't know. It's a second derivative joke or cryptocurrency. But, you know, it just shows you how much cash is out there, how it's lifting asset prices. Like, I was asked at the Federal Reserve to do a thing on bubbles. And what markets did I think were in bubbles? And I went through every market I could think of. And the one I said, sports memorabilia is in a bubble. Baseball cards are clearly in a bubble, right? You look at stocks, right? Are they in a bubble? Well, not with interest rates where they're at.
And isn't it so much of it's got kind of a bounce back from falling off a cliff and things recovering? Or do you think, no, we've done that and then we've done a little bit more?
Well, I think, you know, normally at this point in a recovery, I would say, we're kind of in the second or third inning, right? Like when the Dodgers are winning the World Series. But this is like we went right to the fifth inning. You know, the incredible rally that we've got coming out of the pandemic and the amount of stimulus. You know, people compare this to a war, right? The pandemic was a war. And so I've gone back and I've studied wars. And when you get, there is an interesting corollary is when you have a major war like the First World War, or the Second World War, right after the war is over, and there's been all this stimulus from defense spending and money printing, you get a spike in inflation, which is transitory. So when people talk to me about, is this transitory? Which I'm always like, everything's transitory. Life is transitory. But is this something that is permanent and should we be worried about it in the long run? And I think today the answer is no.
Well,
if you look at all the things that have gone up in price that are in the CPI components, you've got hospitality industry stuff, hotels, airlines, automobiles, right, which are due to the supply chain interruption. It's really a bounce back from what we had in the decline. Now you can say, well, wait a minute, Scott, autos. Well, look, the supply chain interruption to me looks like the retooling that occurred at the end of the Second World War, right? All output, auto plants, everything had been converted to wartime production. There was a transition period in the mid 40s. And during that transition period, people who had saved all this money from the stimulus from the war wanted to spend it. And so auto prices went up. But, you know, what's interesting is there was one period in there, I think it was in 46 or 47, where inflation actually was at 20%. But bond yields never went above 2.25%.
Which doesn't quite make sense, does it?
Well, I think we're living in it today.
So that's interesting. So what's the interest rate environment? Can we make a projection here, Scott, longer term? Is there something different about the relationships here?
Well, you know, I love the phrase, is there something different? You know, I'm a great addict. I loved Ken Rogoff and Carmen Reinach's book, This Time It's Different.
I know.
When I met Ken Rogoff, I had to ask him, where did this title come from? He goes, it's never different, right? So, you know, to your point, I don't think it's different from the standpoint of what I just talked about,
right,
in the periods of time that we're talking about, where you had lots of government spending, lots of money printing, and then you transition. But there is something fundamentally different in that we now have socialized credit. We have now made the central bank the backstop for everything. And this is really unusual because central banks were never designed for this. The Federal Reserve was created after the panic of 1907 to provide some short-term elasticity to money to avoid periods of time where you had spikes in interest rates because of exogenous events like the earthquake in San Francisco, right? So that, of course, ended up setting off a financial crisis. So the idea was, okay, we had this temporary elasticity of credit. This is permanent. I mean, this is MMT. No matter what any rhetoric is out there, we are living in MMT. Well, you know, as I tell people, the history of money is checkered, right? Kings would scrape the edges of silver coins so they could build palaces or fight wars, and they slowly debased their currency, right? Well, the history of paper money is abysmal, right? There has never been a paper money regime that doesn't ultimately end in some sort of hyperinflation, right? And if you go back and you look at Rogoff's work on this subject, he says you get three options, right? You default if you're a government, okay? Not likely, right? Unless we can't get a budget ceiling passed. You can restructure, but that's what people like Argentina do, right? Or you can inflate your way out of it. And so ultimately, and it's interesting because, you know, people say, oh, you know, all this money is inflationary. And I agree with that. But, you know, Milton Friedman famously said that, you know, inflation is always and everywhere a monetary phenomenon. It isn't based on the size of the budget deficit. It isn't based on physical spending. It's a monetary phenomenon. But the thing that people forget is the rest of the statement, which is inflation is always and everywhere a monetary phenomenon subject to long and variable lags, right? And we're living in the age of a long and variable lag.
30 seconds, what then do investors do? How do they need to approach the market? You said there's a lot of bubbles out there.
Well, you know, it's interesting because every investor I have is a long-term investor. And after about 3 months, I find out what the definition of the long-term is. If you're truly a long-term investor, what you really need to do is buy things that will perform well in the long run. Real estate, residential real estate, despite everything people say, is still more affordable than any other period except right after the great financial crisis. The difference today is there's financing available. You know, they're
fixed, ultimately.
Exactly. And you get the option to prepay in our country.
Right.
So, you know, there are a lot of things out there like that. I like also, you know, a lot of the unicorn stocks that are out there. I don't want to mention any of the names because we're invested in some of them. But, you know, this is going to be like the internet. This is going to be transformational. we will probably go through a washout. So if you're a short-term investor, you know, if you're worried about the next year or two, maybe you don't want to go there. But the reality is in 10 to 20 years, it'll be, there are the companies out there today that are Amazon. And I was a genius. I bought Amazon at $9 a share, and I sold it at 14. Okay? So, you know, so there's a big opportunity out there for people who want to wait for the crash. But, you know, ultimately, if you're in it for the long run, as Mary Meeker pointed out back in the internet bubble, buy a broad portfolio of these companies. And at the end of the day, you're going to do really well.
That was Scott Miner, the CIO over at Guggenheim Investments.
Well, a ton of great conversations. It was so much fun to be back live and in person there at the Beverly Hilton. It was your first time, right?
My first time being at the Milken Institute Global Conference, and it was fun.
It was a lot of fun. What's great about it is really a cross-section of obviously the financial community, but there's wellness, there's technology, there's media, there's entertainment. It's just, you know, what Business Week is all about, right? A snapshot of our world.
Right. You can be walking around in the hotel and bump into a movie star or the governor of
California.
Did
you bump into Uma Thurman?
No, I didn't.
I didn't either.
But I could have. She was there.
She was there as well, as were many others. All right, that wraps up the weekend edition of Bloomberg Business Week from Bloomberg Radio. If you missed any of our interviews or want to hear the full interviews just from Milken, just go to the Bloomberg Terminal, also at Bloomberg.com. Thanks so much for joining us. I'm Carol Masser.
And I'm Tim Stenovek. Be sure to tune into our Bloomberg Business Week daily show Monday through Friday. It starts at 2 p.m. Wall Street time on Bloomberg Radio.
You can also watch our daily broadcast on YouTube. Just search Bloomberg Global News.
Also, check out our Bloomberg Business Week podcast. You can find it at Bloomberg.com, Apple, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Bloomberg Business Week is available on newsstands now. It's the special double persuasion issue, so check that out. Lots of great stories there. Find it at Bloomberg.com, BusinessWeek.com, and on the Bloomberg Terminal.
And you can also see me on Bloomberg Quick Take. Available on Bloomberg.com/QT and streaming platforms like Roku, Apple TV, Samsung TV, and more. Have a great weekend.
Stay safe, everyone. This is Bloomberg.